I batted them away. I must keep my face clear. My lungs were bursting, and there were dark spots behind my eyes by the time my feet touched the smooth bottom of the pool. I let my knees bend slightly, pressing my skirts down around me, then shoved upward with all my might. It worked, just barely. My face broke the surface at the top of my leap, and I had just time for the briefest of life-saving gulps before the water closed over me again. But it was enough. I knew I could do it again. I pressed my arms down to my sides to streamline myself and make the descent more rapid. "Once more, Beecham," I thought. "Bend your knees, brace yourself, jump." I shot upward, arms extended overhead. I had seen a flash of red overhead when I broke water last. There must be a rowan tree overhanging the water. Perhaps I could get hold of a branch. As my face broke water, something seized my outstretched hand. Something hard, warm, and reassuringly solid. Another hand. Coughing and spluttering, I groped blindly with my free hand, too glad of rescue to regret the interruption of my escape attempt. Glad, at least, until, wiping the hair out of my eyes, I looked up into the beefy, anxious, Lancashire face of young Corporal Hawkins. Chapter 21. Un mauvais quart d'heure. After another. I delicately removed a strand of still damp water weed from my sleeve and placed it squarely in the centre of the blotter. Then, seeing the inkstand handy, I picked up the weed and dipped it in, using the result to paint interesting patterns on the thick blotting paper. Getting fully into the spirit of the thing, I finished off my masterpiece with a rude word, carefully sprinkled it with sand, and blotted it before propping it up against the bank of pigeonholes. I stepped back to admire the effect, and then looked around for any other diversions that might take my mind off the impending advent of Captain Randall. Not bad for the private office of a captain, I thought, eyeing the paintings on the wall, the silver desk fittings, and the thick carpet on the floor. I moved back onto the carpet in order to drip more effectively. The ride to Fort William had dried my outer garments fairly well, but the underlying layers of petticoat were still wringing wet. I opened a small cupboard behind the desk and discovered the captain's spare wig, neatly bestowed on one of a pair of wrought-iron stands, with a matched silver-backed set of looking-glass, military brushes and tortoiseshell comb laid out in orderly ranks before it. Carrying the wig stand over to the desk, I gently sifted the remaining contents of the sander over it before replacing it in the cupboard. I was seated behind the desk, comb in hand, studying my reflection in the looking-glass, when the captain came in. He gave me a glance that took in my dishevelled appearance, the rifled cupboard, and the disfigured blotter. Without blinking, he drew up a chair and sat down across from me, lounging casually with one booted foot resting on the opposite knee. A riding crop dangled from one fine aristocratic hand. I watched the braided tip, black and scarlet, as it swung slowly back and forth over the carpet. "The idea has its attractions," he said, watching my eyes follow the sweep of the whip. "But I could probably think of something better, given a few moments to collect myself." "I dare say you could," I said, fingering a thick sheaf of hair out of my eyes. "But you aren't allowed to flog women, are you?"
"Only under certain circumstances," he said politely, "which your situation doesn't meet. Yet." "That's rather public, though. I had thought we might get better acquainted in private first."
He reached to the sideboard behind him for a decanter. We sipped the claret in silence, eyeing each other over the wine.
"I had forgotten to offer you felicitations on your marriage," he said suddenly. "Forgive my lack of manners."
"Think nothing of it," I said graciously. "I'm sure my husband's family will be most obliged to you for offering me hospitality."
"Oh, I rather doubt it," he said with an engaging smile. "But then I didn't think I'd tell him you were here."
"What makes you think they don't know?" I asked, beginning to feel rather hollow,
despite my earlier resolve to brazen it out. I cast a quick glance at the window, but it was on the wrong side of the building. The sun wasn't visible, but the light looked yellow. Perhaps mid-afternoon? How long before Jamie found my abandoned horse? And how long after that before he followed my trail into the stream and promptly lost it? Disappearing without a trace had its drawbacks. In fact, unless Randall decided to send word of my whereabouts to Dougal, there was no way on earth the Scots could know where I had gone. "If they knew," the captain said, arching one elegantly shaped brow, "they would presumably be calling on me already. Considering the sorts of names Dougal Mackenzie applied to me on the occasion of our last meeting, I scarcely think he feels me a suitable chaperone for a kinswoman. And the clan Mackenzie seems to think you're of such value that they'd rather adopt you as one of their own than see you fall into my hands. I can hardly imagine they would allow you to languish in durance vile here." He looked me over disapprovingly, taking in every detail of my waterlogged costume, unkempt hair, and generally dishevelled appearance. "Damned if I know what they want you for," he observed. "Or, if you're so valuable to them, why the devil they let you wander about the countryside by yourself? I thought even barbarians took better care of their women folk than that."
A sudden gleam came into his eyes.
"Or have you perhaps decided to part company with them?"
He sat back, intrigued by this new speculation.
"The wedding night was more of a trial than you anticipated," he inquired. "I must confess I was somewhat put out to hear that you preferred the alternative of bedding one of those hairy, half-naked savages to further discussions with me. That argues a high devotion to duty, madam, and I must congratulate whomever employs you on their ability to inspire it. But..."
He leaned still further back in his chair, balancing the claret cup on his knee.
"I'm afraid I still must insist on the name of your employer. If you have indeed parted company with the Mackenzies, the most likely supposition is that you're a French agent. But whose?"
He stared at me intently, like a snake hoping to fascinate a bird. By now I had had enough claret to fill part of the hollow space inside me, though, and I stared back.
"Oh," I said, elaborately polite, "I'm included in this conversation, am I? I thought you were doing quite well by yourself. Pray continue."
The graceful line of his mouth tightened a bit, and the deep crease at the corner grew deeper, but he didn't say anything. Setting his glass aside, he rose, and taking off his wig, went to the cupboard where he placed it on an empty stand. I saw him pause for a moment as he saw the dark grains of sand adorning his other wig, but his expression didn't change noticeably. Unwigged, his hair was dark, thick, fine-textured, and shiny. It was also disturbingly familiar-looking, though it was shoulder-length and tied back with a blue silk ribbon. He removed this, plucked the comb from the desk, and tidied the hair flattened by the wig, then retied the ribbon with some care. I helpfully held up the looking-glass so that he could judge the final effect. He took it from me in a marked manner, and restored it to its place, shutting the cupboard door with what was almost a slam. I couldn't tell whether this delay was in hopes of unnerving me, in which case it was working, or merely because he couldn't decide what to do next. The tension was slightly relieved by the entrance of an orderly bearing a tray of tea things. Still silent, Randall poured out and offered me a cup. We sipped some more.
"Don't tell me," I said finally. "Let me guess. It's a new form of persuasion you've invented. Torture by bladder. You ply me with drinkables until I promise to tell you anything in exchange for 5 minutes with a chamber pot."
He was so taken by surprise that he actually laughed. It quite transformed his face, and I had no difficulty seeing why there were so many scented envelopes with feminine handwriting in the bottom left-hand drawer of his desk. Having let the facade crack, he didn't stifle the laugh, but let it go. Finished, he stared at me again, a half-smile lingering on his mouth.
"Whatever else you may be, madam, at least you're a diversion," he remarked.
He yanked at a bell pull hanging by the door, and when the orderly reappeared, instructed him to convey me to the necessary facilities.
"But take care not to lose her on the way, Thompson," he added, opening the door for me with a sardonic bow.
I leaned weakly against the door of the privy to which I was shown. Being out of his presence was a relief, but a short-lived one. I had had ample opportunity to judge Randall's true character, both from the stories I had heard and from personal experience. But there were those damnable flashes of Frank that kept showing through the gleaming, ruthless exterior. It had been a mistake to make him laugh, I thought. I sat down, ignoring the stench in my concentration on the problem at hand. Escape seemed unlikely. The vigilant Thompson aside, Randall's office was in a building located near the centre of the compound. And while the fort itself was no more than a stone stockade, the walls were 10 feet high and the double gates well guarded. I thought of feigning illness and remaining in my refuge, but dismissed it. And not only because of the unpleasantness of the surroundings. The unpalatable truth was that there was little point in delaying tactics, unless I had something to delay for, and I didn't. No one knew where I was, and Randall didn't mean to tell anyone. I was his, for as long as he cared to amuse himself with me. Once again, I regretted making him laugh. A sadist with a sense of humour was particularly dangerous. Thinking frantically in search of something useful I might know about the captain, I latched on to a name. Half heard and carelessly remembered, I hoped I had it right. It was a pitifully small card to play, but the only one I had. I drew a deep breath, hastily let it out again, and stepped out of my sanctuary. Back in the office, I added sugar to my tea and stirred it carefully. Then cream. Having drawn out the ceremony as long as I could, I was forced to look at Randall. He was sitting back in his favourite pose, cup elegantly suspended in mid-air, the better to look at me over. "Well," I said, "you needn't worry about spoiling my appetite, since I haven't got one. What do you mean to do about me?" He smiled and took a careful sip of the scalding tea before replying, "Nothing."
"Really?"
I lifted my brows in surprise.
"Invention failed you, has it?" "I shouldn't care to think so," he said, polite as usual. His eyes travelled over me once more, far from polite. "No," he said, his gaze lingering on the edge of my bodice where the tucked kerchief left the upper swell of my breasts visible. "Much as I would like to give you a badly needed lesson in manners, I'm afraid the pleasure must be postponed indefinitely. I'm sending you to Edinburgh with the next posting of dispatches, and I shouldn't care to have you arrive damaged in any visible way. My superiors might consider it careless of me."
"Edinburgh?" I couldn't hide my surprise.
"Yes. You've heard of the Tollbooth, I imagine."
I had. One of the most noisome and notorious prisons of the period. It was famous for filth, crime, disease, and darkness. A good many of the prisoners held there died before they could be brought to trial. I swallowed hard, forcing down the bitter bile that had risen at the back of my throat, mingling with the swallow of sweet tea. Randall sipped his own tea, pleased with himself.
"You should feel quite cosy there. After all, you seem to prefer a certain dank squalor in your surroundings."
He cast a condemning glance at the soggy hem of my petticoat sagging below my gown.
"Should be quite homelike after Castle Leoch."
I rather doubted that the cuisine at the Tollbooth was as good as that to be had at Colum's board. And general questions of amenities aside, I couldn't, could not allow him to send me to Edinburgh. Once immured in the Tollbooth, I would never get back to the Stone Circle. The time to play my card had arrived. "Now or never," I raised my own cup.
"Just as you like," I said calmly. "What do you suppose the Duke of Sandringham will have to say about it?"
He upset the hot tea on his doeskin lap and made several very gratifying noises. "Tch, tch," I said reprovingly. He subsided, glaring. The teacup lay on its side, its brown contents soaking into the pale green carpet, but he made no move toward the bell pull. A small muscle jumped in the side of his neck. I had already found the pile of starched handkerchiefs in the upper left-hand drawer of the desk, alongside an enameled snuff-box. I pulled one out and handed it to him. "I do hope it doesn't stain," I said sweetly.
"No," he said, ignoring the handkerchief.
He eyed me closely.
"No, it isn't possible."
"Why not?" I asked, affecting nonchalance,
wondering what wasn't possible. "I would have been told. And if you were working for Sandringham, why the devil would you act in such a damned ridiculous manner?"
"Perhaps the Duke is testing your loyalty," I suggested at random, preparing to leap to my feet if necessary. His fists were bunched at his side, and the discarded riding crop was within much too easy a reach on the desk nearby. He snorted in response to this suggestion.
"You may be testing my gullibility, or my tolerance to irritation. Both, madam, are extremely low."
His eyes narrowed speculatively, and I braced myself for a quick dash. He lunged, and I flung myself to one side. Getting hold of the teapot, I threw it at him. He dodged, and it hit the door with a satisfying crash. The orderly, who must have been lingering just outside, poked a startled head in. Breathing heavily, the captain motioned him impatiently into the room.
"Hold her,"
he ordered brusquely, crossing toward the desk. I began to breathe deeply, both in hopes of calming myself and in anticipation of not being able to do it in a moment. Instead of hitting me, though, he merely pulled out the lower right-hand drawer, which I hadn't had time to investigate, and pulled out a long strand of thin rope. "What kind of gentleman keeps rope in his desk drawers?" I inquired indignantly.
"A prepared one, madam," he murmured,
tying my wrists securely behind me.
"Go," he said impatiently to the orderly, jerking his head toward the door, "and don't come back, no matter what you hear."
This sounded distinctly ominous, and my forebodings were abundantly justified as he reached into the drawer once more. There is something unnerving about a knife. Men who are fearless in personal combat will shrink from a naked blade. I shrank myself until my bound hands collided with a whitewashed wall. The wicked, gleaming point lowered and pressed between my breasts. "Now," he said pleasantly, "you are going to tell me everything you know about the Duke of Sandringham." The blade pressed a little harder, making a dent in the fabric of my gown.
"Take as long as you like about it, my dear. I am in no hurry whatsoever."
There was a small pop as the point punctured the fabric. I felt it, cold as fear, a tiny spot directly over my heart. Randall slowly drew the knife in a semicircle under one breast. The homespun came free and fell away with a flutter of white chemise, and my breast sprang out. Randall seemed to have been holding his breath. He exhaled slowly now, his eyes fixed on mine. I sidled away from him, but there was very little room to manoeuvre. I ended up pressed against the desk, bound hands gripping the edge. If he came close enough, I thought, I might be able to rock backward on my hands and kick the knife out of his hand. I doubted that he meant to kill me, certainly not until he had found out just what I knew about his relations with the Duke. Somehow, that conclusion was of relatively little comfort. He smiled with that unnerving resemblance to Frank's smile, that lovely smile which I had seen charm students and melt the stoniest college administrator. Possibly, under other circumstances, I would have found this man charming, but just at present? No. He moved in fast, thrusting a knee between my thighs and pushing my shoulders back. Unable to keep my balance, I fell heavily backward on the desk, crying out as I landed painfully on my bound wrists. He pressed himself between my legs, scrabbling with one hand to raise my skirts,
while the other fastened on my bared breast, rolling and pinching. I kicked frantically, but my skirts got in the way. He grasped my foot and ran a hand up my leg, pushing damp petticoat, skirt and chemise out of the way, tossing them up above my waist. His hand dropped to his breeches. "Shades of Harry the Deserter," I thought furiously. "What in God's name is the British Army coming to? Glorious traditions, my Aunt Fanny." In the midst of an English garrison, screaming was unlikely to attract any helpful attention, but I filled my lungs and had a try, more as a pro forma protest than anything else. I had expected a slap or shake in return to shut me up. Instead, unexpectedly, he appeared to like it. "Go ahead and scream, sweeting," he murmured, busy with his flies. "I'll enjoy it much more if you scream." I looked him straight in the eye and snapped, "Get stuffed," with perfect clarity and terrible inaptness. A lock of dark hair came loose and fell across his forehead in rakish disarray. He looked so like his 6 times great-grandson that I was seized by a horrible impulse to open my legs and respond to him. He twisted my breast savagely, and the impulse disappeared at once. I was furiously angry, disgusted, humiliated, and revolted, but curiously not very frightened. I felt a heavy, flopping movement against my leg, and suddenly realized why. He wasn't going to enjoy it unless I screamed, and possibly not then. "Oh, like that, is it?" I said, and was rewarded at once with a sharp slap across the face. I shut my mouth grimly and turned my head away, lest I be tempted into any more injudicious remarks. I realized that, rape or not, I was in considerable danger from his unstable temper. Looking away from the sight of Randall, I caught a sudden flicker of movement at the window. "I'll thank you," said a cool, level voice, "to take your hands off my wife." Randall froze with a hand still on my breast. Jamie was crouched in the window frame, a large brass-handled pistol braced across one forearm. Randall stood frozen for a second, as though unable to believe his ears. As his head turned slowly toward the window, his right hand, shielded from Jamie's view, left my breast, sliding stealthily toward the knife which he had laid on the desk next to my head.
"What did you say?" he said incredulously.
As his hand fastened on the knife, he turned far enough to see who had spoken. He stopped again for a moment, staring, then began to laugh.
"Lord help us, it's the young Scottish wildcat. I thought I'd dealt with you once and for all. Back-heeled after all, did it? And this is your wife, you say? Quite a tasty little wench she is, quite like your sister."
Still shielded by his partly turned body, Randall's knife hand swiveled. The blade was now pointed at my throat. I could see Jamie over his shoulder, braced in the window like a cat about to spring. The pistol barrel didn't waver, nor did he change expression. The only clue to his emotions was the dusky red creeping up his throat. His collar was unbuttoned, and the small red scar on his neck flamed crimson. Almost casually, Randall slowly raised the knife into view, point almost touching my throat. He half-turned toward Jamie.
"Perhaps you'd better toss that pistol over here, unless you're weary of married life. If you'd prefer to be a widower, of course."
Their eyes locked tight as a lover's embrace. Neither man moved for a long minute. Finally, Jamie's body relaxed its spring-like tension. He let out his breath in a long sigh of resignation and tossed the pistol into the room. It hit the floor with a clunk and slid almost to Randall's feet. Randall bent and scooped up the gun in a quicksilver motion. As soon as the knife left my throat, I tried to sit up, but he placed a hand on my chest and shoved me flat again. He held me down with one hand, using the other to aim the pistol at Jamie. The discarded knife lay somewhere on the floor near my feet, I thought. Now, if only I had prehensile toes! The dirk in my pocket was as unreachable as if it were on Mars.
The smile hadn't left Randall's features since Jamie's appearance. Now it broadened, enough to show the pointed dog teeth.
Well, that's a bit better.
The pressing hand left my chest to return to the swelling flies of his breeches.
I was engaged when you arrived, my dear fellow. You'll forgive me if I get on with what I was doing before I attend to you.
The red colour had spread completely over Jamie's face, but he stood motionless, the gun pointed at his middle. As Randall finished his manoeuvres, Jamie launched himself at the open mouth of the pistol. I tried to scream to stop him, but my mouth was dry with terror. Randall's knuckles whitened as he squeezed the trigger. The hammer clicked on an empty chamber, and Jamie's fist drove into Randall's stomach. There was a dull, crunching sound as his other fist splintered the officer's nose, and a fine spray of blood spattered my skirt. Randall's eyes rolled up in his head, and he dropped to the floor like a stone. Jamie was behind me, pulling me up, sawing at the rope around my wrists.
"You bluffed your way in here with an empty gun?" I croaked hysterically.
"If it were loaded, I would have just shot him in the first place, wouldn't I?"
Jamie hissed. Feet were coming down the corridor toward the office. The rope came free, and Jamie yanked me to the window. It was an 8-foot drop to the ground, but the footsteps were almost to the door. We jumped together. I landed with a bone-shaking jar and rolled in a tumble of skirts and petticoats. Jamie jerked me to my feet and pressed me against the wall of the building. Feet were passing the corner of the building. 6 soldiers came into view, but didn't look in our direction. As soon as they were safely past, Jamie took my hand and motioned toward the other corner. We sidled along the building, stopping short of the corner. I could see where we were now. About 20 feet away, a ladder led up to a sort of catwalk that ran along the inside of the fort's outer wall. He nodded toward it. This was our objective. He brought his head close to mine and whispered, "When you hear an explosion, run like hell and get up that ladder. I'll be behind you." I nodded, understanding. My heart was going like a trip hammer. Glancing down, I saw that one breast was still exposed. Not much to be done about it just at present. I wrapped up my skirts, ready to run. There was an almighty roar from the other side of the building, like a mortar explosion. Jamie gave me a shove and I was off, running as fast as I could go. I jumped for the ladder, caught it, and scrambled up. I felt the wood jerk and tremble as Jamie's weight hit the ladder below me. Turning at the top of the ladder, I had a bird's-eye view of the fort. Black smoke was billowing up from a small building near the back wall, and men were running toward it from every direction. Jamie popped up beside me. "This way!" He ran, crouching along the catwalk, and I followed. We stopped near the flagstaff set in the wall. The ensign flapped heavily above us, halyard beating a rhythmic tattoo against the pole. Jamie was peering over the wall, looking for something. I looked back over the camp. The men were clustering at the small building, milling and shouting. Off to one side, I spotted a small wooden platform set 3 or 4 feet high with steps leading up. Heavy wooden posts rose out of the centre, cross-beamed, with rope manacles dangling from the arms of the cross. Suddenly, Jamie gave a whistle. Looking over the wall, I saw Rupert mounted and leading Jamie's horse. He looked up at the sound of the whistle and manoeuvred the horses close to the wall below us. Jamie was cutting the halyard from the flagpole. The heavy red and blue folds of the flag drooped and slid down, landing with a swishing thud next to me. Twisting a rope end rapidly around one of the struts, Jamie tossed the rest down the outside of the wall.
"Come on," he said. "Hold tight with both hands. Brace your feet against the wall. Go!"
I went, bracing my feet and paying out rope. The thin cordage slipped and burned in my hands. I dropped next to the horses and hurried to mount. Jamie vaulted into the saddle behind me a moment later, and we took off at a gallop. We slowed our pace a mile or two from the camp when it became apparent that we had lost any pursuers. After a short conference, Dougal decided that we had better make for the border of the Mackintosh lands,
as being the closest safe clan territory.
Doonesbury's within riding distance by tonight, and likely to be safe enough. There'll be word out on us tomorrow, but we'll be across the border before it reaches there.
It was mid-afternoon by then. We set off at a steady pace, our horse with its double load lagging slightly behind the others. My horse, I supposed, was still happily eating grass in the copse, waiting to be led home by whoever was lucky enough to find it.
"How did you find me?" I asked. I was beginning to shake in reaction, and folded my arms around myself to still the quivering. My clothes had dried completely by this time, but I felt a chill that went bone deep.
"I thought better of leaving you alone and sent a man back to stay with you. He didn't see you leave, but he saw the English soldiers cross the ford and you with them."
Jamie's voice was cold. I couldn't blame him, I supposed. My teeth were beginning to chatter.
"I'm surprised that you didn't just think I was an English spy and leave me there."
"Dougal wanted to, but the man who saw you with the soldiers said you were struggling. I had to go and see, at least."
He glanced down at me, not changing expression.
"You're lucky, Sassenach, that I saw what I did in that room. At least Dougal must admit that you're not in league with the English."
"Dougal, eh? And what about you? What do you think?" I demanded.
He didn't reply, but only snorted briefly. He did at last take pity on me to the extent of jerking off his plaid and flinging it over my shoulders. But he wouldn't put his arm around me, nor touch me more than strictly necessary. He rode in grim silence, handling the reins with an angry jerkiness quite unlike his usual smooth grace. Upset and unsettled myself, I was in no frame of mind to put up with moods.
"Well, what is it, then? What's the matter?" I asked impatiently. "Don't sulk, for heaven's sake."
I spoke more sharply than I intended, and I felt him stiffen still further. Suddenly, he turned the horse's head aside and reined up at the side of the road. Before I knew what was happening, he had dismounted and jerked me from the saddle as well. I landed awkwardly, staggering to keep my balance as my feet hit the ground. Dougal and the others paused, seeing us stop. Jamie made a short, sharp gesture, sending them on, and Dougal waved in acknowledgement.
"Don't take too long," he called, and they set off again.
Jamie waited until they were out of earshot. Then he yanked me around to face him. He was clearly furious, on the verge of explosion. I felt my own wrath rising. What right did he have to treat me like this?
"Sulking," he said. "Sulking, is it? I'm using all the self-control I've got to keep from shaking you till your teeth rattle. And you tell me not to sulk."
"What in the name of God is the matter with you?" I asked angrily.
I tried to shake off his grip, but his fingers dug into my upper arms like the teeth of a trap.
"What's the matter with me? I'll tell you what the matter is, since you want to know," he said through clenched teeth. "I'm tired of having to prove over and over that you're no an English spy. I'm tired of having to watch you every minute for fear of what foolishness you'll try next. And I'm very tired of people trying to make me watch while they rape you. I didn't enjoy it a bit."
"And you think I enjoy it?" I yelled. "Are you trying to make out it's my fault?"
At this, he did shake me slightly.
"It is your fault. Did ye stay put where I ordered ye to stay this morning, this would never have happened. But no, you won't listen to me. I'm no but your husband. Why mind me? You take it into your mind to do as you damn please, and next I ken I find you flat on your back with your skirts up and the worst scum in the land between your legs on the point of taking you before my eyes."
His Scots accent, usually slight, was growing broader by the second. Sure sign that he was upset, had I needed any further indication. We were almost nose to nose by this time, shouting into each other's face. Jamie was flushed with fury, and I felt the blood rising in my own face.
"It's your own fault for ignoring me and suspecting me all the time.
I told you the truth about who I am. And I told you there was no danger in my going with you. But would you listen to me? No, I'm only a woman. Why should you pay any attention to what I say? Women are only fit to do as they're told and follow orders and sit meekly around with their hands folded, waiting for the men to come back and tell them what to do. He shook me again, unable to control himself.
And if you'd done that, we wouldn't be on the run with 100 redcoats on our tail. God, woman, I didn't know whether to strangle you or throw you on the ground and hammer you senseless. But by Jesus, I want to do something to you.
At this, I made a determined effort to kick him in the balls. He dodged and jammed his own knee between my legs, effectively preventing any further attempts.
Try that again and I'll slap you till your ears ring, he growled.
You're a brute and a fool, I panted, struggling to escape his grip on my shoulders. Do you think I went out and got captured by the English on purpose?
I do think you did it on purpose, to get back at me for what happened in the glade.
My mouth fell open. In the glade? With the English deserters?
Aye. You think I should have been able to protect you there, and you're right. But I couldn't do it. You had to do it yourself. And now you're trying to make me pay for it by deliberately putting yourself, my wife, in the hands of a man that shed my blood.
Your wife? Your wife? You don't care a thing about me. I'm just your property. It only matters to you because you think I belong to you, and you can't stand to have someone take something that belongs to you.
You do belong to me,
he roared, digging his fingers into my shoulders like spikes.
And you are my wife, whether you like it or no.
I don't like it. I don't like it a bit. But that doesn't matter either, does it? As long as I'm there to warm your bed, you don't care what I think or how I feel. That's all a wife is to you. Something to stick your cock into when you feel the urge. At this, his face went dead white, and he began to shake me in earnest. My head jerked violently and my teeth clacked together, making me bite my tongue painfully. Let go of me, I shouted. Let go, you... I deliberately used the words of Harry the Deserter, trying to hurt him. You rutting bastard! He did let go, and fell back a pace, eyes blazing.
You foul-tongued bitch! You'll no speak to me that way.
I'll speak any way I want to. You can't tell me what to do.
Seems I can't. You'll do as you wish, no matter who you're hurt by it, won't you? You selfish, willful...
It's your bloody pride that's hurt! I shouted. I saved us both from those deserters in the glade, and you can't stand it, can you? You just stood there. If I hadn't had a knife, we'd both be dead now. Until I spoke the words, I had had no idea that I had been angry with him for failing to protect me from the English deserters. In a more rational mood, the thought would never have entered my mind. It wasn't his fault, I would have said. It was just luck that I had the knife, I would have said. But now I realized that, fair or not, rational or not, I did somehow feel that it was his responsibility to protect me, and that he had failed me. Perhaps because he so clearly felt that way. He stood glaring at me, panting with emotion. When he spoke again, his voice was low and ragged with passion.
You saw that post in the yard of the fort?
I nodded shortly.
Well, I was tied to that post, tied like an animal and whipped till my blood ran. I'll carry the scars from it till I die. If I'd not been lucky as the devil this afternoon, that's the least as would have happened to me. Likely they'd have flogged me, then hanged me.
He swallowed hard and went on. I knew that. And I didn't hesitate for one second to go into that place after you, even thinking that Dougal might be right. Do you know where I got the gun I used? I shook my head, numbly, my own anger beginning to fade.
I killed a guard near the wall. He fired at me. That's why it was empty.
He missed, and I killed him with my dirk, left it sticking in his wishbone when I heard you cry out.
I would have killed a dozen men to get to you, Claire. His voice cracked. And when you screamed, I went to you, armed with nothing but an empty gun and my two hands. Jamie was speaking a little more calmly now, but his eyes were still wild with pain and rage. I was silent. Unsettled by the horror of my encounter with Randall, I hadn't at all appreciated the desperate courage it had taken for him to come into the fort after me. He turned away suddenly, shoulders slumping.
"You're right," he said quietly. "Aye, you're quite right."
Suddenly, the rage was gone from his voice, replaced by a tone I had never heard in him before, even in the extremities of physical pain.
"My pride is hurt, and my pride is about all I've got left to me."
He leaned his forearms against a rough-barked pine and let his head drop onto them, exhausted. His voice was so low I could barely hear him.
"You're tearing my guts out, Claire."
Something very similar was happening to my own. Tentatively, I came up behind him. He didn't move, even when I slipped my arms around his waist. I rested my cheek on his bowed back. His shirt was damp, sweated through with the intensity of his passion, and he was trembling.
"I'm sorry," I said simply.
"Please forgive me." He turned then to hold me tightly. I felt his trembling ease bit by bit.
"Forgiven, lass," he murmured at last into my hair.
Releasing me, he looked down at me, sober and formal.
"I'm sorry, too," he said. "I'll ask your pardon for what I said. I was sore, and I said more nor I meant. Will you forgive me, too?"
After his last speech, I hardly felt that there was anything for me to forgive, but I nodded and pressed his hands. "Forgiven." In an easier silence, we mounted again. The road was straight for a long way here, and far ahead I could see a small cloud of dust that must be Dougal and the other men. Jamie was back with me again. He held me with one arm as we rode, and I felt safer. But there was still a vague sense of injury and constraint. Things were not yet healed between us. We had forgiven each other, but our words still hung in memory, not to be forgotten. Chapter 22 Reckonings. We reached Doonesbury well after dark. It was a fair-sized coach stop, with an inn, fortunately. Dougal closed his eyes briefly in pain as he paid the innkeeper. It would take quite a bit of extra silver to ensure his silence as to our presence. The silver, however, also ensured a hearty supper with plenty of ale. Despite the food, supper was a grim affair, eaten mostly in silence. Sitting there, in my ruined gown, modestly covered by Jamie's extra shirt, I was plainly in disgrace. Except for Jamie, the men behaved as though I were completely invisible, and even Jamie did no more than shove bread and meat in my direction from time to time. It was a relief at last to go up to our chamber, small and cramped though it was. I sank on the bed with a sigh, disregarding the state of the bedclothes. "I'm done in. It's been a long day."
"Aye, it has that."
Jamie unfastened his collar and cuffs and unbuckled his sword belt, but made no move to undress further. He pulled the strap from the scabbard and doubled it, flexing the leather meditatively. "Come to bed, Jamie. What are you waiting for?" He came to stand by the bed, swinging the belt gently back and forth.
"Well, lass, I'm afraid we've a matter still to settle between us before we sleep tonight."
I felt a sudden stab of apprehension.
"What is it?"
He didn't answer at once. Deliberately not sitting down on the bed by me, he pulled up a stool and sat facing me instead.
"Do you realise, Claire," he said quietly, "that all of us came close to being killed this afternoon?"
I looked down at the quilt, shamefaced. "Yes, I know," My fault. I'm sorry.
Aye, so you realise, he said. Do you know that if a man among us had done such a thing, to put the rest in danger, he would have likely had his ears cropped or been flogged, if not killed outright?
I blanched at this.
No, I didn't know.
Well, as I know you're not yet familiar with our ways, and it's some excuse. Still, I did tell you to stay hid, and had you done so, it would never have happened. Now the English will be looking high and low for us. We shall have to lie hid during the days and travel at night now.
He paused.
And as for Captain Randall, aye, that's something else again.
He'll be looking for you especially, you mean, now that he knows you're here.
He nodded absently, looking off into the fire.
Aye. It's personal with him, you know.
I'm so sorry, Jamie, I said.
Jamie dismissed this with a wave of the hand.
Yeah, if it were only me it hurt by, I wouldn't have seen more about it. Though, since we're talking...
He shot me a sharp glance.
I'll tell you that it near killed me to see that animal with his hands on you.
He looked off into the fire, grim-faced, as though reliving the afternoon's events.
I thought of telling him about Randall's difficulties, but was afraid it would do more harm than good. I desperately wanted to hold Jamie and beg him to forgive me, but I didn't dare to touch him. After a long moment of silence, he sighed and stood up, slapping the belt lightly against his thigh.
"Well, then," he said, "best get on with it. You've done considerable damage by crossing my orders, and I'm going to punish you for it, Claire. You recall what I told you when I left you this morning?"
I recalled all right, and I hastily flung myself across the bed, so my back was pressed to the wall.
"What do you mean?"
"You know quite well what I mean," he said firmly. "Kneel down by the bed and lift your skirts, lass."
"I'll do no such thing."
I took a good hold on the bedpost with both hands and wormed my way further into the corner. Jamie watched me through narrowed eyes for a moment, debating what to do next. It occurred to me that there was nothing whatever to stop him doing anything he liked to me. He outweighed me by a good 5 stone. He at last decided on talk rather than action, though, and carefully laid the strap aside before crawling over the bedclothes to sit beside me.
"Now, Claire," he began.
"I've said I'm sorry," I burst out, "and I am. I'll never do such a thing again."
"Well, that's the point," he said slowly. "You might, and it's because you didn't take things as serious as they are. You come from a place where things are easier, I think. 'Tis not a matter of life or death where you come from to disobey orders or take matters into your own hands. At worst, you might cause someone discomfort or be a bit of a nuisance, but it isn't likely to get someone killed."
I watched his fingers pleating the brownish plaid of his kilt as he arranged his thoughts.
"It's the hard truth that a light action can have very serious consequences in places and times like these. Especially for a man like me."
He patted my shoulder, seeing that I was close to tears.
"I know you would never endanger me or anyone else on purpose, but you might easily do so without meaning it, like you did today, because you do not really believe me yet when I tell you that some things are dangerous. You're accustomed to think for yourself, and I know," he glanced sideways at me, "that you're not accustomed to letting a man tell you what to do. But you must learn to do so, for all our sakes."
"All right," I said slowly. "I understand." "You're right, of course.
All right. I'll follow your orders, even if I don't agree with them."
"Good." He stood up and picked up the belt.
"Now then, get off the bed and we'll get it over with."
My mouth dropped open in outrage. "What? I said I'd follow your orders."
He sighed, exasperated, then sat down again on the stool. He looked at me levelly.
"Now, listen. You understand me, you see, and I believe it.
But there's a difference between understanding something with your mind and really knowing it deep down. I nodded reluctantly. All right. Now, I will have to punish you, and for two reasons. First, so that you will know. He smiled suddenly.
I can tell you from my own experience that a good hiding makes you consider things in a more serious light.
I took a tighter hold on the bedpost.
The other reason, he went on, is because of the other men. You'll have noticed how they were tonight.
I had. It had been so uncomfortable at dinner that I was glad to escape to the room.
There's such a thing as justice, Claire. You've done wrong to them all, and you'll have to suffer for it.
He took a deep breath.
I'm your husband, so it's my duty to attend to it, and I mean to do it.
I had strong objections to this proposal on several levels. Whatever the justice of the situation, and I had to admit that at least some of it lay on his side, my sense of amour propre was deeply offended at the thought of being beaten, by whomever and for whatever reason. I felt deeply betrayed that the man I depended on as friend, protector, and lover intended to do such a thing to me. And my sense of self-preservation was quietly terrified at the thought of submitting myself to the mercies of someone who handled a 15-pound claymore as though it were a fly-whisk. "I will not allow you to beat me," I said firmly, keeping a tight hold on the bedpost.
"Oh, you won't?"
He raised sandy brows.
"Well, I'll tell you, lass. I doubt you've much to say about it. You're my wife, like it or not. Did I want to break your arm or feed you naught but bread and water or lock you in a closet for days? And don't think you don't tempt me either. I could do that, let alone warm your bum for you.
I'll scream."
"Likely. If not before, certainly during. I expect they'll hear you at the next farm. You've got good lungs."
He grinned odiously and came across the bed after me. He pried my fingers loose with some difficulty and pulled firmly, hauling me to the side of the bed. I kicked him in the shins, but did no damage, not having shoes on. Grunting slightly, he managed to turn me face down on the bed, twisting my arm to hold me there.
"I mean to do it, Claire. Now, if you'll cooperate with me, we'll call the account square with a dozen strokes."
"And if not?" I quavered. He picked up the strap and slapped it against his leg with a nasty thwapping sound.
"Then I shall put a knee in your back and beat you till my arm tires, and I warn you, you'll tire of it long before I do."
I bounced off the bed and whirled to face him, fists clenched. "You barbarian! You sadist!" I hissed furiously. "You're doing this for your own pleasure. I'll never forgive you for this." Jamie paused, twisting the belt. He replied levelly,
"I dinna know what's a sadist. And if I forgive you for this afternoon, I reckon you'll forgive me too, as soon as you can sit down again." "As for my pleasure..."
His lip twitched.
"I said I would have to punish you. I did not say I wasn't going to enjoy it."
He crooked a finger at me.
"Come here."
I was reluctant to leave the sanctuary of the room next morning and fiddled about, tying and untying ribbons and brushing my hair. I hadn't spoken to Jamie since the night before, but he noticed my hesitation and urged me to come out with him to breakfast.
"You dinna need to fear meeting the others, Claire.
They'll chaff you a bit likely, but it won't be bad.
Shin up."
He chucked me under the chin and I bit his hand sharply, but not deep.
"Ooh!"
He snatched his fingers back.
"Be careful, lass. You don't know where they've been."
He left me, chuckling, and went into breakfast. He might well be in a good mood, I thought bitterly. If it was revenge he'd wanted the night before, he'd had it. It had been a most unpleasant night. My reluctant acquiescence had lasted precisely as far as the first searing crack of leather on flesh. This was followed by a short, violent struggle, which left Jamie with a bloody nose, three lovely gouges down one cheek, and a deeply bitten wrist. Not surprisingly, it left me half smothered in the greasy quilts, with a knee in my back, being beaten within an inch of my life. Jamie, damn his black Scottish soul, turned out to be right. The men were restrained in their greetings, but friendly enough. The hostility and contempt of the night before had vanished. As I was dishing eggs at the sideboard, Dougal came up and slipped a fatherly arm around my shoulders. His beard tickled my ear as he spoke in a confidential rumble.
"I hope Jamie wasn't too harsh with you last night, lass. It sounded as though you were being murdered, at least."
I flushed hotly and turned away so he wouldn't see. After Jamie's obnoxious remarks, I had resolved to keep my mouth firmly shut through the whole ordeal. However, when it came to the event, I would have challenged the Sphinx itself to keep a shut mouth while on the receiving end of a strap wielded by Jamie Fraser. Dougal turned to call to Jamie, seated at the table eating bread and cheese.
"He now, Jamie, it wasn't necessary to half-kill the lass. A gentle reminder would have sufficed."
He patted me firmly on the posterior in illustration, making me wince. I glowered at him.
"A blistered bum never did anyone no permanent harm," said Murta through a mouthful of bread. "No, indeed," said Ned, grinning. "Come and have a seat, lassie."
"I'll stand, thank you," I said with dignity, making them all roar with laughter. Jamie was careful not to meet my eyes as he studiously cut up a bit of cheese. There was a bit more good-natured chaff during the day, and each of the men made some excuse to pat my rump in mock sympathy. On the whole, though, it was bearable, and I gradually began to consider that Jamie might have been right, though I still wanted to strangle him. Since sitting down was completely out of the question, I busied myself during the morning with small chores such as hemming and button sewing, which could be done at the windowsill, with the excuse of needing the light to sew by. After lunch, which I ate standing, we all went to our rooms to rest. Dougal had decided that we would wait till full dark to set out for Bargrennan, the next stop on our journey. Jamie followed me to our room, but I shut the door firmly in his face. "Let him sleep on the floor again." He had been fairly tactful last night, buckling his belt back on and leaving the room without speaking immediately after he'd finished. He'd come back an hour later, after I'd put out the light and gone to bed, but had had sense enough not to try to come into bed with me. After peering into the darkness where I lay unmoving, he had sighed deeply, wrapped himself in his plaid, and gone to sleep on the floor near the door. Too angry, upset, and physically uncomfortable to sleep, I had lain awake most of the night, alternately thinking over what Jamie had said, with wanting to get up and kicking in some sensitive spot. Were I being objective, which I was in no mood to be, I might admit that he was right when he said that I didn't take things with the proper seriousness. He was wrong, though, when he said it was because things were less precarious in my own place, wherever that was. In fact, I thought it was more likely the opposite was true. This time was in many ways still unreal to me, something from a play or a fancy dress pageant. Compared to the sights of mechanized mass warfare I had come from, the small pitched battles I had seen, a few men armed with swords and muskets, seemed picturesque rather than threatening to me. I was having trouble with the scale of things. A man killed with a musket was just as dead as one killed with a mortar. It was just that the mortar killed him personally, destroying dozens of men, while the musket was fired by one man who could see the eyes of the one he killed. That made it murder, it seemed to me, not war. How many men to make a war? Enough, perhaps, so they didn't really have to see each other. And yet this plainly was war, or serious business at least, to Dougal, Jamie, Rupert, and Ned. Even little rat-faced Murta had a reason for violence beyond his natural inclinations. And what about those reasons? One king rather than another? Hanovers and Stuarts? To me, These were still no more than names on a chart on the schoolroom wall. What were they compared with an unthinkable evil like Hitler's Reich? It made a difference to those who lived under the kings, I supposed.